by rolling this way, I can kind of get information that I'll need as we present the story. But tell me a little about yourself, Dr. Mark Neely, just your current role, position, and...
Well, I teach history at Penn State University, where we have a Civil War era center there, and called the Richard Civil War Era Center, and we specialize in Civil War studies there. And I'm one of a group of people there who teaches the Civil War.
Former director of the Lincoln Museum in Indiana.
That's right. I was there for 20 years.
Where is that located?
Fort Wayne, up in the northeast corner of the state. Actually, it's not there any longer, but that's where it was when I worked there.
Okay, excellent. Oh, Dr. Neely, I believe you are the first speaker in the 2012-2013 EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, which is a longstanding and ongoing lecture series, part of this year's year-long observance of the Civil War sesquicentennial. Your topic for your talk is Lincoln and the Constitution?
That's right.
And I've noticed that you had written an essay, Was the Civil War a Total War? Tell me about that essay. That the meaning of that sounds is a little obscure to me, and I'm a little very curious about what you mean.
Well, a lot of the historians who wrote, particularly at the time of the centennial of the Civil War, around the 1960s and before, they wrote in, I would call it, they wrote in the shadow of World War II. And World War II, you know, was won by the vast population resources of the Soviet Union and by the economic might of the United States. And it was furthermore characterized in our memory by strategic bombing. And so what they did was write as though the Civil War were like World War II, and that civilians were indiscriminately targeted, and that it was won by economic mobilization and basically modern techniques which mobilized the total society and made everyone a target. So it was a total war. And I argued a long time ago that I didn't think that was the case with the Civil War. The Civil War was restrained by the traditional laws of international laws of warfare, and the idea of civilian casualties was something that, for example, Lincoln himself strove at all times to prevent. And in general, the generals in the Civil War had sort of internalized values that made them – they wanted to strike at the enemy's army and leave the civilians to carry on their tasks. So it was a much more traditional-looking war than it looked to the people writing in the shadow of World War II.
And, of course, in the Civil War, the enemy – was literally our own citizens, our fellow citizens of the United States prior to the secession movement.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that was ultimately a restraining force, although we tend to think of civil wars as being especially terrible kinds of wars. But I don't think that the United States Civil War was. And in fact, you're right that that was one of the mitigating qualities for the Union generals and the Union armies.
One of the issues you are concerned with is the issue of presidential power and civil liberties in wartime. How does that apply to the Civil War?
Well, Abraham Lincoln, very early in the war, suspended the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, which meant that a person could be arrested without charge and held, and the person couldn't ask for this traditional writ of liberty, that is, say, why am I being held? And if a judge issues a writ, it's just an order. If the judge issues this order, why, then the arresting authority is supposed to appear with the have the body, corpus, appear with the person arrested and explain the charges under which he is held. So if the writ's suspended, the judge's demand for that does not have to be met. And the arresting officer, say, can come in and say, we don't have to explain why he's being held. And I am very interested in that now in this respect. In fact, it's one of the things I'm going to talk about in the lecture series. And that is, I think there's a fair amount of mythology that attaches to the writ of habeas corpus. We have a sense that the writ of habeas corpus is maybe the keystone of all the other liberties, something like that. And in some ways it is. If you look it up in Black's Law Dictionary, you can find a good definition of it in there. But what's interesting to me about it is that it's cross-referenced with the great writ. I mean, it has a fabulous reputation, the writ of habeas corpus. But I decided, for one thing, to look at how it was actually used. When a judge issued one of these orders, what was it like? And far from being what we think of, say that the judge issues the order and the arresting authority brings the prisoner in and is embarrassed to find an explanation, especially if he's a military officer who's arrested a civilian. In fact, actually, most in a majority of cases, I think if you tried to find the average writ of habeas corpus that was issued during the Civil War by a judge, what he would have brought in was a person who hadn't been arrested at all. In fact, the person would be a soldier. And they regarded military restraint as a kind of restraint that the courts could call into question. And in fact, actually, the commonest case was for a soldier who was underage. You had to be 18 years old to enlist without the permission of your parents. And so in the Civil War, a lot of boys under 18 wanted to do what their brothers were doing and join the army, or they wanted to get off the farm where their fathers exploited their labor. And so underage, they enlisted. And it was very hard to prove someone's age in those days because there were no birth certificates. So once you're in the army, though, sometimes the glory didn't prove to be quite all that you'd expected, and they'd want to get back out. And so their parents might find them and want to get them out. But one way or another, young soldiers were seeking writs of habeas corpus in the courts, and the judges would bring them in. Their officers had to come in and explain whether they were of age when they enlisted or not. And if the judge thought they weren't, the judge would release them. So that, I think, is not exactly what we thought the writ of habeas corpus did. We thought it protected freedom of speech. We thought it kept newspaper editors from, they could question their arrest if the military authorities arrested them. And that happened some. But in most of the cases, they were, in fact, military arrests. Before the war, if you look at the uses of the writ of habeas corpus, and this was still a use of it during the war itself, one of the common uses was in child custody cases, to issue a writ to demand that the parent bring in the child and show why the other parent shouldn't have custody.
So the point is that Lincoln was not violating the civil liberties of American citizens during the war. Has he been unjustly accused of taking such action?
I think the real question at the time hinged on whether the president could suspend the writ of habeas corpus or not. The clause of the Constitution that governs it, that says the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended except in cases of invasion or rebellion when the public safety requires it, doesn't say who. It happens to appear in Article 1, which is the part of the Constitution governing the powers of Congress. And so it had been assumed — it had never been done — it had been assumed that only Congress could suspend it. Well, Lincoln faced a rebellion while Congress wasn't in session, and he felt that the emergency demanded it, the public safety demanded it, and he suspended it. So there was a great deal of criticism of him for expanding presidential powers and for then making arrests. So my arrests that, as you indicated, arrests that violated important, freedom of speech and other liberties that Americans expect and should have. And my point is that if you look at it as a practical uses, that there were many reasons to suspend it, and that Lincoln tailored his suspensions to those cases so that he suspended the writ several times. And in each one, he specified what kinds of cases, and the cases were typically military ones for underage soldiers and that sort of thing.
What were the controversial elements of Lincoln's record beyond issues of civil liberties of this type? Certainly with a certain element, namely the secessionists, the national unity, his effort of preserving national unity was not something that was respected. His efforts to abolish slavery, were there other issues?
Well, of course, the issues that we have just talked about, the freedom of speech, freedom of the press in wartime, those were key issues. But you're right to point to secession and to the Emancipation Proclamation as key issues. Now, on secession, Lincoln, it's quite remarkable. On December 17th, 1860, Lincoln sat down to write a letter that had to answer a letter that had been sent to him by a Republican politician in New York, a powerful man. He had to answer the letter. And in the course of the letter, the person who wrote it was Thurlow Weed. He was a right-hand man of William Seward, who had become Lincoln's Secretary of State. He asked Lincoln what his views on secession were. And Lincoln could write back on December 17th, 1860. He wrote back and said, "I don't think if you look at my speeches, you'll find anything on secession." Now, December 17th is the day the South Carolina Secession Convention met. And Lincoln has no record on this subject. But so he has to think fast and devise arguments fast, and he was very good at that. And his initial impulse, of course, is to say that he's there to enforce the laws and that he should, as he put it, run the machine as he received it. Now, the Emancipation Proclamation is a different matter. The Constitution, this is one of the things I always stress and that I want to talk about when I speak here in Kentucky tonight. The Constitution was, by and large, a big asset during the Civil War for winning the war because of Article II, which describes the presidential powers. It gives the president a four-year term, and it makes the president the commander-in-chief. Well, since the Civil War began almost at exactly the point a presidential administration began, that meant that a determined Republican would be in place for four long years to combat secession. And that was a powerful factor. It meant that Lincoln really didn't have to worry as much about public opinion as you might think. His generals could suffer defeats, and although it alarmed public opinion, he's basically there for 4 years, and he can look for another general. If we'd had a parliamentary system, the Lincoln administration wouldn't have lasted 17 months.
Because he would have been recalled?
Yes, right. There would have been a vote of no confidence, and the administration would have fallen probably in July 1862. But because of the Constitution, Lincoln is there. Now, it's an asset for winning the war, but the Constitution is a problem for ending slavery. The Constitution, though not by name, the Constitution mentions slavery three times in the Three-Fifth Compromise, apportioning representation in the House, in the notorious Fugitive Slave Clause, and also in the clause saying that Congress wouldn't have the power to abolish the international slave trade for 20 years. And so this was a big problem for anti-slavery advocates like Lincoln, that the Constitution, although it doesn't use the word slavery, that slavery is mentioned in the Constitution and clearly condoned by it. But they had an answer to it, and that was that when slavery is mentioned in the Constitution, it's never mentioned by name. It's the founders used clumsy euphemisms for it. For example, persons held to service or labor. Instead of saying slaves, they said persons held to service or labor. And what the anti-slavery movement said was that was proof that the founders didn't want any specific mention of slavery in the Constitution. Sure, they had to compromise with it now, but somewhere out there in the future, slavery was going to disappear from the United States, and there wouldn't even be a memory of it in the Constitution. So that a person like Lincoln then can look at the Constitution as basically a liberal document in which abolishing slavery is possible. But it was much more problematic than the war powers that he could otherwise use as commander-in-chief.
How do you compare and rate presidential administrations on their enforcement of or their overall position on civil liberties? I mean, I assume you compare the Lincoln administration to others, and I assume you bring that up to date.
Yes.
Well.
In fact, that's something else I want to talk about while I'm here. And I've been writing about civil liberties in the Civil War for over 25 years, and I have devised a system for comparing and rating the president's records. And so I think there are three questions you have to ask of any wartime administration about civil liberties. And one of them is what I would call the provocation test. That is, how great was the provocation? And was the internal security system that was put in place, was it proportionate to the provocation? A second question you have to ask, and I get this from the law professor Jeffrey Stone in particular, is what I call the victim's test. And that is, even if you put an internal security system into place that is aimed at saboteurs and fifth column activities, what's to keep you from using it for other things, to arrest people who to the administration were undesirable for other reasons? And that's very worrisome. It was the main worry in the 19th century that such a system would be used to eliminate the opposition party, the loyal opposition. That's sort of their central problem. So you want to look and see who actually got arrested. And then third, this is something that's pointed out by Jeffrey Stone. You should have an internal security system should have a sunset provision. In other words, when the provocation is over, does the internal security system also end? And that's very important. Presumably, that's how in many cases we get dictators. You know, they say, oh, it's an emergency. We have to have emergency powers. And then the emergency sort of never ends. And in Lincoln's case, of course, it's a question with no answer because he's murdered before the war is over, and we can't tell for sure what would have happened to his internal security system, had he lived to see the war completely over. But anyway, those are the three questions you must ask of any administration.
So how does the Lincoln administration weigh up based on those three factors?
Well, I think the provocation was certainly very great. What other president has faced something on the scale of the Civil War? In terms of victims, I would say that Lincoln himself worked very hard to make it so that the system, as I said about the writ of habeas corpus, the system was aimed at preventing desertion and preventing people from discouraging enlistment in the army. That didn't always work. He didn't have control of the far-flung officers throughout the Union, and there were plenty of things that violated that spirit. But that was certainly the spirit he wanted to have. And then finally on the question of whether he would have ended the system when the provocation ended, well, we'll never know.
So does your work then bring these issues to play in looking at current and recent presidential administrations? I, of course, we're thinking in terms of 9/11 and what occurred in the Bush administration and going forward. How do these administrations, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, prior to it, Clinton, and a potential President Romney, how do they weigh up under these tests and these measures?
Well, I would say that I have provided a system. and you can apply it and answer it and say, do they pass the provocations test? Do they pass the victims test? Do they have a provision to end the system when the threat is ended? And you can measure them that way. I prefer, I write only about dead people. And so rating the current president or the living presidents is not something that I do. But we can look back and think about Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and we can think of measuring their internal security systems by asking these questions. And I think if you do it, you'll find that Lincoln measures up very favorably.
So what new information are you bringing forward in your talk on Lincoln and the Constitution as you speak for the Chautauqua Lecture Series at EKU? What is the new revelation or the new information that the audience will hear?
Well, my principal point is to say that we have a tendency to think that the Constitution was a problem for Lincoln during the Civil War. In fact, if you went to the library and wanted to find the answers to constitutional questions about the Lincoln administration, the best place to look is a book by James G. Randall called Constitutional Problems Under Lincoln. Mm-hmm. It's a great book. It was written in 1926, but it's a very good book. But it has left us a problematic legacy in the title. And that legacy is that it causes us to think that Lincoln had only constitutional problems. And my argument is that the Constitution was a great asset and for winning the war. And I have another proof of it. And that is, of course, if people were to look at the Confederate Constitution, the first thing you'd say if you looked at the Constitution of the Confederate States of America is that it was plagiarized. It sounds exactly like the United States Constitution. There are a few changes in it. Of course, slavery is specifically condoned, and the presidential term is lengthened to 6 years. The president's not allowed to succeed himself. But otherwise, it looks very much like the United States Constitution. And I would say that one of the reasons that the Confederacy was able to put up the fight it did against the odds that it faced was that it had this same Constitution, which is very good for fighting wars.
Why is an observance like the sesquicentennial of the Civil War commemorating events of certainly importance and great significance, such as the Civil War? Why is it important to us today in the 21st century to take a look at these issues and these historical elements? How will we be better as a society or even as individuals?
Well, I think there are as many answers to that question as there are people to answer it. My own answer is that I have learned nearly everything I understand about the United States Constitution from looking at the Constitution in the Civil War and the way Lincoln used it. I think that most presidents, and certainly in crisis times since then, have learned from Lincoln and the Civil War experience or studied it to see if there are things to learn from it. And for me, to understand the Constitution this way is one of the important legacies of looking at the Civil War. I think other people might have other answers.
Dr. Mark Neely, thank you. Welcome again to Eastern Kentucky University, and thanks for sharing your information with us.
Thank you.